I think of them as living blueprints. God has a plan for the master universe. And these architects are the living embodiments of that plan. They're living, intelligent, administrative, walking blueprints.
Not personal?
They're super persons. They're more than personal.
Anybody on the second floor has to be super person, right?
I think so. I think so, Helena. I think so. I'm not sure. I've never been up there. These folks are super personal, I'm sure. But that doesn't mean that we can't deal with them. For example, when we enter the core of the finality, the being who swears us in is the senior architect.
Does it tell how many there are of them?
Yes, yes.
Three?
We'll get to that. We'll do it right now if you want to. You have one architect on the paradise level. Three on the Havona level. Seven architects on the super universe space level. Gee, that makes sense, doesn't it? There's seven super universes. There are 70 architects assigned to the first outer space level. And here's something very interesting. I think I can find it. Take my word for it. In one place in the papers, they speak of the observations of their astronomers, not ours. And they say that in the first outer space level, they have already detected 70 major aggregations of matter, any one of which is vastly greater than the super universe. This is big. You remember when they compute the output of paradise gravity? You see, if you can measure how much gravity paradise is exercising, you have measured the mass of creation, haven't you? Since paradise puts out gravity in direct proportion to the mass it has to control. And only 5% of paradise gravity is accountable for in the grand universe. No, 15%, I think. Let's check that. 5%. 95% of the present gravity output of paradise is engaged in controlling material creations outside of the seven super universes in Havona.
What percent?
95%. You get this on page 132. Fifteen percent of the mind gravity of the infinite spirit is unaccountable for, unless it's operating out in outer space. So you got intelligence out there. I think force organizers. Apparently, all of the spirit gravity of the eternal sun can be accounted for by the seven super universes in Havona. But they hedge a little bit. They say, look, if there were a few spirit beings out there, the number is so small, we don't think we could pick it up, see? The inference is that solitary messengers maybe can go out there. Maybe inspired Trinity spirits can go out there. As the papers say, they're the only two revealed to us who can collaborate with force organizers. Now, I don't believe in numerology. But I do believe that there is a logic to numbers. For example, the Mendelian ratio is a basic law of chance. We'll get into the Mendelian ratio because it appears all throughout these papers. As you get these so-called fourth creatures, you know, like the divine executioners and the conciliating commissions, why were there seven master spirits and not six and not eight? Well, you compute it out. There, if you take the three deities singly and severally, there are only seven possible expressions, right?
Yeah.
It's inherent in the number. Okay. If the essence of the growth of the Supreme is the collaboration between the Supreme Creators and the Paradise Deities, and if the seven Master Spirits are primarily expressive of the Supreme Creators, and we know this to be a fact, at least in the case of Majestan, then if there is a number which would attach to the Supreme Being, it would be 10, wouldn't it? 7 in relation to 3. Is there any warrant for that? I say yes. Let's take a look at, again, this can be in either of two places, doggone it.
Well, there's a lot on 480 on it.
So the worlds of the Father contain the potentials of the whole Master Universe. And in discussing the rulers of these worlds, they're discussing the Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy. And there are 10 Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy on each of the Father's worlds. You remember Divinington, Sonerington, so on.
Is that page 208?
208, yes. The work of each of these special worlds is divided into 7 major departments, and one of these coordinate rulers presides over each such division of specialized activities. The remaining 3 act as the personal representatives of triune deity in relation to the other 7, one representing the Father, one the Son, and one the Spirit. I think where you encounter the number 10, you encounter the function of the Supreme Being. And let's see if this stands up to logic. Does the number 10 appear prior to the appearance of the Supreme Being? The answer is no. In this calculation. But the number 10 repeats on each of the outer space levels from the first to the fourth. And I think it's there because the Supreme Being is functioning. Are you with me? When I first read these numbers, I thought, gee, they make no sense after you go up a little ways. But I got my clue, 70 to 490. It's the square of 7 times 10. And naturally, what do? But you take the cube. This is 7 to the third power times 10. And lastly, 7 to the fourth power times 10. If you have any doubts, multiply it out for yourself. In other words, you multiply 7 by itself 4 times, and then multiply by 10, and the answer is 24,010. So it seems to me that the Supreme Being is a functional reality in all universe ages after the present one. And I would like to refer to them as the post-supreme ages. The Supreme Being functions in the Master Universe. He has 3 levels of function. He functions primarily in Havona as a spirit person. Secondarily, in the Grand Universe as a personality of power, an evolving sovereign. The tertiary function of the Supreme Being is of Master Universe scope and is an unknown potential. Master Spirit number 7 is a perfect blend of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. These are the architects. Now, we got into this because we're talking about the first experiential Trinity. And I think it's very significant that the completion of the Master Universe witnesses the appearance of a Trinity. The completion of Havona witnessed the appearance of a Trinity. Now, are we going to get a Trinity every time we complete something? No. There are only three Trinities projected. When will the second experiential Trinity appear? Whenever God the Ultimate appears. And when will God the Ultimate appear? Not until the whole Master Universe has been completed. So I'd like to throw at you, I like to go back to nucleus and cytoplasm again.
Don't throw it too hard.
I think that you get a nuclear universe every time a Trinity forms. Havona is obviously the nucleus of the grand universe, isn't it? And the Paradise Trinity formed concurrent with the appearance of Havona. I would like to submit that the grand universe, the seven super universes as dependent on Havona, I'm including the whole thing now, is the second nuclear universe. Because a Trinity forms concurrent with the full appearance of the grand universe. And by full appearance, I mean the perfecting of the grand universe. I think that the grand universe is the nucleus, the true nucleus, of the Master Universe.
So is this a conjecture?
Isn't Havona just the nucleus? Because I think the nucleus must have within it the seeds of growth for the future. And Havona is perfect. Havona basically, inherently, is non-experiential. I think you've got to add an experiential component to existential Havona in order to get a real nucleus for an experiential universe. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Consider the argument about what is and what is not a nucleus. I think Havona is a nucleus for the grand universe because, one, it is central in relation to the cytoplasmic superuniverses. It's the yolk in relation to the white of the egg, and we're out here in the white. Two, its nature is radically different from the superuniverses. Three, you have to write this down. I got it all in writing for you, and Julia's going to duplicate it. Three, hereditary characteristics are transmitted by it to the superuniverses. This follows the dictionary definition of a nucleus. And I think we're safe if we deal with organic comparisons. I don't like mechanical comparisons. This is not a piece of machinery. This is a living organism. Four, the birth of the Havona nucleus is associated with the birth of a Trinity. And fifth, deity appears whose nature is like the nature of the nucleus. Havona's perfect, so also is the infinite spirit perfect. Now, just stop and say Havona is the nucleus of the Master Universe. Well, I just don't think it's adequate. Because if a nucleus is to transmit hereditary characteristics, then the nucleus must contain those potentials within it. And certainly even Havona was non-evolutionary until Grand Fanda landed. I would offer this argument in favor of conceiving of the grand universe, the perfected grand universe, as a second nucleus. Let's see. We've got by our process of reasoning a queer duplication of events, haven't we? We started with two existential deities and a power base. We wind up here with two experiential deities and a power base. I would suggest that these two experiential deities are going to duplicate experientially what the Father and Son did at the beginning of all things. Now, these deities are not infinite, are they? No. The Father and the Son are. But while these two experiential deities are sub-infinite, they're very great, are they not? Just stop and think. Our local universe is 1/100th part of approximate of a little less than 1/7th of the tennis ball. And they have got the moon mobilized. They're able to mobilize the whole of the experiential magnitude of the completed master universe because they grew it and grew with it. And I think what they're going to do is to trinitize. Visualize the supreme and the ultimate engaging in a trinitizing act. The papers refer to supreme-ultimate as they refer to Father-Son. It's a form of union involving the appearance of an equal being. And what are they going to trinitize? I think they're going to attempt to trinitize God the Absolute. And that throws some light on a very cryptic statement in the foreword. Let's jump ahead to 15, section 12, the Trinities. Let's, you folks, just quickly scan that section. I don't want to take time to read it.
What page, Bob?
Page. Point I'd like to direct your attention to is on page 16, paragraph 6. The ultimate Trinity, that's the first experiential Trinity, is experientially unifying in completion. We've just been talking about that. And when it finally unifies, the master universe is complete, and we have God the ultimate. But we truly doubt the possibility of such full unification of the absolute Trinity. That's the second experiential Trinity. In other words, if the second experiential Trinity could completely unify, they would experientialize God the absolute out of the deity absolute. But if they could do that, they could exhaust infinity. We're in a paradox here, aren't we? Our concept, however, of the eternal paradise Trinity is an ever-present reminder that deity trinitization may accomplish what is otherwise non-attainable. Hence do we postulate the sometime appearance of the supreme ultimate and the possible trinitization factualization of God the Absolute. That's what we're attempting to account for here in this discussion. Doesn't that paragraph mean a lot more to you now? And again, I've got to have very simple, simple pictures. This trinitizing act is symbolized in my mind by the following picture. There are two mighty experiential brothers, a greater and a lesser. They are carrying a stupendous battering ram. This battering ram is the earned experiential sovereignty of the whole master universe. They are approaching a formidable wall that is labeled absolute. And as they arrive before this wall, the ultimate says to the supreme, "Swing hard, brother. We are going through." They know full well that they can never knock this wall down, but they also know that they are going to breach it. Consider, just consider the massiveness of the battering ram they are swinging, the total vastness of the mighty mobilization of all the experience in the completed master universe. Yes, Helene. Look, are we going to be there? I submit yes. And here's my reason. The reason I offer you this speculative thinking is because it's a string on which I've been able to string so many beads in these papers that help illuminate them. Next to the last paragraph, page 1226, next to the last paragraph. The type of personality bestowed upon Urantia mortals has a potentiality of seven dimensions of self-expression or person realization. And don't ask me why it has this, because that's the way God designed it. It comes from Him with these properties. These dimensional phenomena are realizable as three on the finite level, first floor. Three on the absonite level, second floor. And one on the absolute level, third floor. This supreme dimension is an associable absolute. And while not infinite, is dimensionally potential for sub-infinite penetration of the absolute. Let's kick that around. We have got the equipment right now necessary. When they breach this wall, we can't breach it. Well, we can go through any hole they make. What does sub-infinite penetration of the absolute mean? Well, I use this illustration later on. I can't drink all of the orange juice in the city of Chicago, but that doesn't mean I can't drink some and can't keep on drinking orange juice. Havona is a sub-infinite portrayal of God's concept of an absolutely perfect universe. It isn't infinite though, is it? It's got an outer edge. I think that we'll be there when this takes place. And I think that it will take place just as sure as the darn thing started. You see, just as Jesus portrays the divine path to God, so the Supreme Being is the pathway from finite limitations to absonite adventures. And so the supreme and the ultimate are the pathway to the final adventure, the never-ending attempt to find out more and more and more about God as absolute. This is a growth we can start, and isn't it wonderful that we can never finish it? Listen, it's sort of like, here, consider a 10-year-old's concept of success, and then a 20-year-old's concept of success, and then a 50-year-old concept of success, and someday we'll be 50 million years old, and someday 50 billion years old. And someday we'll look upon 50 billion years as a very small segment of time. We will be making plans involving units of many times 50 billion years. This is not impossible. Think back in your own experience. When you were a kid, you remember second or third grade? Do you remember the summer vacations between those school years? How long they were? They were awfully long. Mm-hmm. Well, when you've lived a billion years, you can think about a billion years. You can think a billion years ahead. Can't you?
Mm-hmm.
What we've done is we have really explored the toughest concept in the papers, I think. The seven levels of total deity function. We spent two whole days on one page in the foreword. And it'll go a lot faster from here on.
How long did it take you to unravel this thing?
I got the idea in about 3 days.
You did? Make the framework?
Yeah. It took about 3 months to put it in the third draft. I'm working on the fourth draft now.
All right.
Is that
doing that on your own?
Stop right here now if you want to. We run overtime, damn it. Tomorrow, if you'd like to, we might spend an hour or so considering some problems of the cosmos infinite.
Nice.
Would you be intrigued?
I'd be intrigued.
Well, I'll share my speculation with you. I forgot we should quit at 4:30, but I don't think I'd have quit anyway. It was too... I just finished a 2-volume review of medieval history before I started in to read it in detail. In the first place, there are many different religious beliefs in this world. And within each of the major beliefs, there are many contending groups. About the only group I think that is pretty well unified are the Parsis. And they're the ragtag remnant of Zoroastrianism, and there are only about 100,000 of them. So they don't differ very much in theology. Mohammedanism is divided into different contending sects. I've forgotten the terms, but the Persians belong to a Mohammedan group that differs considerably from the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. You have many, many different aspects of Hinduism. Buddhism has not only its two major divisions, but many minor divisions. And of course, the most shameful religion of all is Christianity. Do you know of any religion which is more subdivided than Christianity? And let's not talk about the pristine purity of the Christian past. This can be discussed only by a person who is wholly ignorant of European history. Christianity was shot full through with so-called heresies. And please remember that the word heresy is defined by those who triumph. The losers are the heretics. The difference between Jefferson Davis and George Washington is the difference between failure and success in heading a revolution. our established religious beliefs are not too well established. I do not work particularly in churches. I do some work in churches. But my principal work is done in business. And I listen to the reaction of businessmen to churches. And I'm telling you, they're pretty fed up with them. They think that ministers have a vested interest in maintaining sectarian differences. There is an impatience, not so much with God and religion as with ecclesiastical organizations. This is something that ministers don't hear. But I happen to be a sheep in wolf's clothing, and I hear plenty of it. These established religions are in many ways like the whited sepulchers that Jesus talked about. They've got imposing edifices, but there isn't as much religion inside of them as you might think. I remember old Bill Hale's grandmother, who made the remark, she was a very devout old lady. And she says, I haven't been in a damn church in years. She says, they don't talk about Jesus anymore. They're talking about teacher salaries and corrupt government and labor unions and so on. I think it's a very sad, this is something I wouldn't discuss now with the man in the street, but you folks are supposed to be your ranch, and so I talk to you frankly. If in a seminar like this I have to be guarded in my speech, something's wrong with you folks and wrong with me. I think it's a very sad commentary on the state of Protestantism when the two most active exponents of Protestantism are Norman Vincent Peale on the one hand and Billy Graham on the other. Billy Graham is going back to fundamentalism, and Norman Vincent Peale is selling magic. When you use religion in an effort to get what you want, this is the practice of magic. When you use prayer to find out what God wants, this is real prayer. People today are hungry. They're just as hungry for God as they've ever been. But all too often they have the experience of Robert Ingersoll, who walked into a church looking for bread, and as he said, they fed him wind pudding. I don't know too much about the clergy. My life has not fallen along those lines, but I did spend a week in a church giving a series of lectures. And during the week, I was asked to attend a district conference of ministers. And I attended this conference. There were about, 20 parsons there assembled. And I want you to know I felt very much at home. Very little difference between this group and a group of district sales managers. They were talking about quotas, territories, and the like. The one difference, yes, they sang much more beautifully than a group of district sales managers. But I felt very much at home in this down-to-earth, practical, economic atmosphere. They were in business. I had a real erudite talk prepared to give these guys. I think mainly I was going to show them that I was as smart as they were. I tore my talk up, and I talked to them from my heart. I said, look, gentlemen, I said, I'm disturbed. This isn't worth recording, Paul. I said, I'm real disturbed. I said, you know, I make my living as a business advisor. And I said, if I come to one of your churches and you offer me the bread of this world, I said, frankly, I will scorn you because I think I know more about the bread of this world than you do. I know more about economic and business conditions than the clergy does. But I said, if you were to offer me the bread of life eternal, I would be in the market. And I said, the thing I'd like to get across to you in conventional Christian terms is this, and I take it from one of Paul's letters. If I were you, I would be resolved to know nothing but Christ and Him crucified. That's their semantics. That isn't your ancient semantics. The organized religions, I do not think, are delivering the merchandise. And I think that's why this book has come along. Not to upset the established religions, but to provide bread for people who can't find it in the established bakeries. The bread that's being dished out by too many established churches is too much like the bread that's being dished out by bakeries. It's become devitalized. Most of the nutritional value has been taken out of it. I think the world is hungry for this book. You know, in essence, this is exactly the attitude of the Jewish clergy when Jesus showed up. I mean, this was a... Why did he have to come along and upset a good thing? Every new revelation is always disturbing to the established order. But I think we need this. I think we need it pretty badly. I can buy the Urantia book. I can believe it. I can try to live up to it. But you want to know something? I cannot buy the religion about Jesus. It isn't real. I can't make it work. I can't live up to it. I don't want to try. I'm not interested in the blood of the Lamb. I have no feeling of original sin. The kind of God that would get mad at the human race is not the kind of God I can worship. This is an act that's unworthy of a human father, much less a divine father. I can't buy Paul's Christianity, but I can buy the teachings of Jesus. And for the first time, we've got them separated out. That's my opinion as to why we have this book. In God's house, the furnace is in the basement. Another paradise, the paper on paradise, as we'll get into, I hope. For those of you who haven't been here during the days, we've spent 4 sessions, 2 mornings and 2 afternoons, and I think we're about through with page 2 of the foreword.
We're a bright group.
When we get into paper 11, which discusses paradise, we'll discover that the paper is neatly divided into 2 topical halves. The first half discusses paradise as the place where God lives and where we will live someday. And the second half discusses the furnace room, the boiler house, the power plant, which is paradise functioning as the material governor of the material universes. And people just don't go there. Even the author of the paper says, "I only know what I've been told." He's very frank. "I don't know except what I've been told is there." You don't want to go into a detailed discussion of it, do you? All right. If you think of it as the boiler room and the power plant, that's a pretty good way of thinking of it. The furnace is in God's house, is in the basement, just like it is in a normal house. Cosmos.
Bill,
he is. It is.
Why?
This is the fulcral point of the unqualified absolute.
She can hear.
But it's more than just.
Oh yes. Let's see the wording that they use. It's very cleverly put in here. Yes. It's in one of the zones on Nether Paradise. This is believed to be the central focalization, the paradise center of the space presence of the unqualified absolute.
Until he comes down and reopens the door.
He also pervades all space, but here's his central focalization. Dark bodies the same as dark bodies.
What?
If not, what is the difference? I know what you mean. There are two kinds of dark bodies described in these papers. And let's get their technical terminology. 52, they're talking about the two belts of dark gravity bodies surrounding Havona. Now, these dark gravity bodies surrounding Havona are like no other matter anywhere, because they exhibit both linear and circular gravity. They exhibit the kind of gravity that is peculiar to paradise, and they also exhibit the kind of gravity that is like the gravity we know about, straight line gravity. And they're found only in these two belts surrounding the central universe and nowhere else. Now, I believe what this question refers to is another type. On page 173, paragraph 2, there is a term, the dark islands of space. You all know that a sun is tremendously larger than a planet. But when you have a dark, non-luminous, cold body as massive as a sun, then they use this special term for it, a dark island of space. It is a tremendously massive thing. Jupiter would be a peanut alongside of it. It's got the gravity pull of a sun, a blazing sun, but it itself, it may be a burned out sun. That would be one origin of a dark island of space. They use that specialized term to deal with a cold space body whose size is altogether of a larger magnitude than the size of even a big planet. Yes?
Bill, aren't those...
Let's take a look. And this is entirely different now from a dark gravity body. They use different terms. Let's take a quick look at the story of the birth of the Urantia solar system. 55. Now wait a minute, I'm gonna look. Size, volume, massiveness. Yeah. Massiveness of material creation. Listen, if there are 70,000 aggregations in the first outer space level, each one of which is bigger than a super universe, what do they mean when they say that more than 50 million years on beyond in the second outer space level, there are far greater energy activities? Holy smokes. Now, we have no data given anywhere as to dimensions of the second outer space level. But we've developed two members of a series, and we can speculate concerning the third member, because 1 is to 100 as 100 is to 10,000. That's just an ordinary proportion. Now, this assumes we recognize a rate of increase. We can have two choices now. Is the increase constant, or is the increase accelerating? Is this thing growing by arithmetic progression or geometric progression? We have absolutely no way of estimating an accelerating factor. We don't know that it isn't accelerating. But since we can't even estimate such a factor, I have elected to speculate on the more conservative side and to assume that the rate of acceleration is the constant rate which we've deduced. So, we draw an inch. Now we've gone from paradise roughly out to the edge of Orvandan. Then we draw 100 inches. Now we've crossed the first outer space level. Now to get across the second outer space level, we draw 10,000 inches. Remember, this is only the linear relationship. The cubic relationship is something else again. And I got tired of multiplying at this point, so I didn't work it out. If you represent the grand universe by a 2-inch circle, the first outer space level goes out around 8 feet. And the second outer space level goes out around 800 feet.
From 2-inch.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Of course, it goes in both directions that far. I'm just going out in one direction. It keeps it simpler. Are you still with me?
Yeah.
I'm trying to be.
Yes.
You're talking about just from the center across the ring, not
sure.
All the way across.
Oh no, I'm just
the
going.
Diameter.
I'm going out in a straight line from the center.
Radius.
We're dealing with radiuses
yeah.
Here.
Radius. Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
The diameter is twice this number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How big is the third outer space level? Well, if we have an inch, 8 feet, 800 feet, then we can project the distance across the third outer space level as 80,000 feet. Just to make it easy to figure, let's take a mile at 5,000 feet instead of 5,280. And we can see that the third outer space level is 16 miles across.
Oh, from 1 inch.
Orvandan is an inch across. The third outer space level is 16 miles across.
That doesn't account for the dead space between.
I'm just ignoring it. It's small in relation to the whole.
Does the space between stay the same between each one?
We have no way of knowing. I would say not. I think that the quiet zones get bigger, mm-hmm. farther across.
Well,
how about the fourth outer space level? Let's just summarize it. If the grand universe is a 2-inch circle, the first outer level is 8 feet out, farther out, or a 16-foot circle. The second outer level is 800 feet farther out, or a 1,600-foot circle. The third outer level is 16 miles farther out, or a 32-mile circle. Then the fourth outer level is 1,600 miles out, or a circle 3,200 miles in diameter. You know, I want to tell you, the weekend I worked out these numbers, I damn near dropped my teeth on the desk.
It's very hard on my brain.
Now, let's get this thing down and make it real simple. I want you to visualize a tennis ball. It's somewhere close to 2 inches in diameter, a little oversized. I don't care about precision here now. All I'm seeking for here is a feeling for this. Can you see the tennis ball?
2 inches in what?
2 inches in diameter. This is all in writing here, Julia.
You
know
that, well, I need tribute from it.
All right. Can you visualize a small bedroom? 8 feet cubic. Float the tennis ball in the small bedroom.
The tennis ball is the grand universe.
Yes. Now you're thinking of the seven super universes, Antimona, in relation to the size of the first outer space level.
Oh, mm-hmm.
We'll use this term tennis ball several times. Now, let's visualize a city block with 10 80-foot lots on it. These are comfortable building sites. It's a little less than 100-foot front footage. It's an 800-foot block with 10 comfortable houses on it. Now, make a cube out of this block and float our little bedroom in the cubic block. You've now got the first outer space level in relation to the second outer space level.
The block is the second.
The block is the second, right. A city block.
Yeah.
I gotta get things that we feel for, you know. I tried to think of what would be a 16-mile cube, and I decided we might cube the city of Chicago. You can't cube Los Angeles because it's almost bigger than North America.
Yeah.
But float our city block in cubic Chicago. And now you've got the second outer space level in relation to the third. Well, I kept reaching around what would symbolize the fourth. There isn't anything that works exactly. But the diameter of the moon is 2,100 miles. What we need is something that's 3,200 miles. But the moon is the nearest object I can think of that's the right magnitude to float Chicago in. And now we've got the fourth outer space level. The moon is only two-thirds as big as it should be for the illustration. But it's a lot bigger than Chicago. Tennis ball, bedroom, city block, cubic city in the moon.
Now that's easy. Yeah.
You got a feel for it, right. I wanted to take you through the math so that it wouldn't seem unreasonable. But these numbers don't, 10,000 inches doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah. I'm scared to think what might be beyond that.
You know, when you do the
safari,
you're kind of willing for space to have an end.
Now, you see, we'll discuss that. You see, the architects go up in numbers. But the thing that is misleading is this. The architects are taking in individually more and more space the farther out they go. This ascending series doesn't begin to suggest how much bigger it gets on the way out, right? Let's have a coffee break dedicated to the tennis ball in the moon.
How large is that bedroom?
And on. Yes.
These maps and sketches that you bring.
Think about these bedrooms and things. We should be thinking of concentric donuts, shouldn't we? That's the way really to think about them. But I find it easier to use terms like cubic blocks and bedrooms and so on. Do you see why each finaliter company has got attached to it 1,000 gravity messengers?
Mm. No, why? They go fast.
They go in standard. And when you're dealing with distances like this, you've got to have some pretty high velocity communication techniques. These distances are so great that a solitary messenger would take a while getting there, you know?
Yeah.
And a poor seraphim who can only go three times the velocity of light. Well, it takes a seraphim a third of 500,000 years to go from here to Uversa. That's a long trip. It takes light 500,000 years, and it takes a seraphim one-third of that length of time. Of course, a solitary messenger can get there pretty fast.
And does the gravity messenger go faster?
Yeah.
Than a solitary messenger?
Sure, gravity messenger uses gravity, and that moves in standard. I think they give the time it takes the thought adjuster to come from Divinington to take up residence in a human being on your rancher. It took about 11 minutes, which was spent in registration on your versa.
And the same time to go back when a person died?
They don't take, they, thought adjusters traverse space independently of time.
They're the fastest.
They're as fast as gravity messengers. Gravity messengers are very much like thought adjusters. They're fragments of the Universal Father. Let's just take a look at it. They're discussed in just one place in the papers, in the connection with the core of the finality. Page 346. It says, there's 1,000 of them attached to each finality company of 1,000, and the chief gravity messenger is a member of the finality company. It says no other group of intelligent creatures possesses such a personalized messenger corps able to transcend time and space. Similar types of messenger recorders attached to other finality group corps are not personalized. They are absentized. And I don't ask me what that means. I don't know. Gravity messengers hail from Divinington, and they are modified and personalized adjusters. But no one of our Uversa group will undertake to explain the nature of one of these messengers. We know they are highly personal beings, divine, intelligent, and touching the understanding, but we do not comprehend their timeless technique of traversing space.
So they are personalized adjusters?
Yes, they are.
I didn't know that.
It says gravity messengers and glorified mortal finaliters achieving a touching and profound affection for one another. They have much in common. One is a direct personalization of a fragment of the Universal Father. The other, a creature personality existent in the surviving immortal soul fused with a fragment of the same Universal Father, the thought adjuster.
Lord.
The reason I believe that we're going on and on and on is not because we're such a much, but adjusters are. I'm not so sure that we've got the legs to go this far, but we're riding a horse that's a fragment of infinity. I think we're going to go right on through following the Michaels. The papers suggest that the Michaels are never going to stop the invasion of space. There's a wonderful statement here. See if I can find it. Wish me luck. 45. It's in their discussion of universal absolute unity. I'm starting a little below the middle of the page. And God the Father is the personal source of all manifestations of deity and reality to all intelligent creatures and spirit beings throughout all the universe of universes. As personalities, now, or in the successive universe experiences of the eternal future, no matter if you achieve the attainment of God the Sevenfold, comprehend God the Supreme, find God the ultimate, or attempt to grasp the concept of God the absolute, you will discover to your eternal satisfaction that in the consummation of each adventure, you have on new experiential levels rediscovered the eternal God, the Paradise Father of all universe personalities. That's why I've left my firehouse on the Black Fork. It doesn't make any difference what floor we manage to achieve. The center pole is there, and that is the personality of the Universal Father. And the only change that's taken place is in us. We now approach him with a quart-sized comprehension instead of a pint-sized, and later on with a gallon-sized. The Universal Father is the explanation of universal unity, as it must be supremely, even ultimately realized in the post-ultimate unity of absolute values and meanings, unqualified reality. That's the third floor. Oh, I love this. Last two paragraphs. The Master Force organizers go out into space and mobilize its energies to become gravity responsive to the paradise pull of the Universal Father. And subsequently, there come the Creator Sons, who organize these gravity-responding forces into inhabited universes, and therein evolve intelligent creatures who receive unto themselves the spirit of the Paradise Father, subsequently ascending to the Father to become like Him in all possible divinity attributes. The ceaseless and expanding march of the Paradise creative forces through space seems to presage the ever-extending domain of the gravity grasp of the Universal Father and the never-ending multiplication of varied types of intelligent creatures who are able to love God and be loved by Him, and who, by thus becoming God-knowing, may choose to be like Him, may elect to attain paradise and find God. And that's just as true of outer spacers as it's true of us. Only, in outer space, we will be a part of the living ladder on which they will climb, just as the Havoners and Paradise personalities have made themselves into a living ladder for us to climb, from the status of an animal up to the portals of Paradise. Well, fellow Argonauts, leave us have at.
Here,
may
I ask a question?
Yes.
Would you kind of have...
To Havona. The ability to comprehend is the passport to paradise. Those are the three great milestones. Sure. Paul, ology and cosmology out of it. This complicated book is the simplest religion ever presented to man. The boss man is your father and wants you. And if you want him, who the hell could keep you apart? There's nobody bigger than the boss.
That's a very good illustration, Bill.
And you require no intermediaries. He touches you twice. You're in the personality circuit because you have personality and free will choice, and a piece of him lives inside of you. Now that's terrifying and comforting at the same time. This complex religion is at the same time the simplest religion that's ever been presented on this world. It's complex this week because this is not a revival meeting. This is a study group. We're approaching these papers intellectually. Helena?
The,
Last paragraph. Quote.
I can't skip any of this anyway.
Ability to comprehend is the mortal passport to paradise. Willingness to believe is the key to Havona. The acceptance of sonship, cooperation with the indwelling adjuster, is the price of evolutionary survival. Very simple. Just as much as the other citation I read you is very simple. You go adventuring. You encounter many new things. But at the heart of each adventure, you keep finding the same God, the same Universal Father, unchanging, still loving. Only you have changed. You can understand more. Remember the great statement they make in these papers, that God is the first truth and the last fact. To feel God is the first touch of divinity which a creature like us can have. But to understand God as a fact, that is at the end of eternity. Yes.
Really,
in this great adventure, we're exploring God. That's what we're doing. And at the same time, we are developing capacity to explore the fragment of God within us, while we explore the creation of God on the outside, and then we take both experiences, and periodically, I think we go back to paradise. And each time, we find the same God, only we're a little higher up on the pole. Do you follow me? We think we have found more of God. He was always there. We just have more finding capacity. Well, all set, Paul? Come with me now. And we took a good look at the third universe age, the age of the first outer space level. Let's consider what lies in the remaining outer space levels. I think it's futile to try to separate them. But let's consider continuing growth as we proceed from the bedroom into the cubic block, the cubic city, and the moon. I would make this first observation. These outer space levels are not going to differ radically from each other, as the super universes differ radically from Havona, and as the completed master universe differs radically from the outer space levels. I think they represent enormous expansions. And let's consider what kind of expansions. First of all, I would suggest that the collaboration between the Spirit and the Supreme Being will continue. I think that sets the tone for all four of the outer space levels. As it was Father, Son in Havona, as it is Son, Spirit out here, it is Spirit Supreme out there. And that doesn't mean that the Father and the Son are inactive. The Universal Father is functioning right out here now, but not as a creator. He's a bestower of personality. He is a bestower of thought adjusters. He's a bestower of love. But he's delegated. He's not a selfish God, is he? As soon as someone can do the job, he lets them have at it, have fun with it. And don't you stop and think, if he didn't do that, there wouldn't be a job for any of us. There is no job that the Father couldn't do better or as well. I think that this continuation, I think there will be a continuation of Son-Spirit collaboration with a further differentiation of the Michaels from space level to space level, from universe age to universe age, with a further differentiation of the creative spirits, with a further differentiation of their trinitized offspring. The third unknown member. I would submit number three, there will be a further growth in Trinity collaboration, to wit, the Paradise Trinity of Father, Son, and Spirit, collaborating with the first experiential Trinity, composed of the Supreme Creators, the Architects of the Master Universe, and the Supreme Being. This trinity is known as the Trinity of Ultimacy. Pardon me, the Trinity Ultimate. And its final function and final success will contribute to the appearance of God the ultimate. I've debated, why are there four outer space levels? Why not two? Why not ten? There are four.
I know it, but it just seems as if there ought to be three to me.
But there aren't. There are four.
Or seven.
Maybe we don't know. Yeah, we don't know. Or maybe this will be a little clearer later on, yes.
Doesn't that make seven altogether going up to the beginning?
No, not unless you count paradise, and they say not to count it. It's not in space. There are six space levels. The architects of the master universe are in seven levels, but number one has to do with paradise. Well, let's kick around. On page 333, paragraph 1, it states in part, eventuated transcendental beings, quote, are existent on four ultimate levels of personality activity. Is this why there are four outer space levels? And these four levels of ultimacy should not be confused with what they elsewhere refer to as the seven levels of the absinthe.
You're reading.
You're
reading.
Yes. Paragraph 1. 333, paragraph 1. Consider also, what does this exponential factor of 7 mean? Of the 7 times 10 combinations. The architects of the outer space level are all expressive in 7 times 10. 7 to the first power in the first level, 7 to the second power in the second level, the third and the fourth power. I get a queer feeling about this. I had difficulty putting it in words, but I put it this way. Does this exponential expansion, first, second, third, and fourth powers of 7, signify not only a quantitative increase, but also a qualitative penetration of the whole transcendental level? This hypothesis advances the thought that the post-supreme ages represent some kind of an exponential expanding march through ultimacy. The transcendental level really exhausts ultimacy. The best illustration I know of that is something, I wonder how symbolic this story is. When you add up all these architects, the sum total is 28,011 universe planners. I'm reading from on page 352, paragraph 3. 28,011. On paradise, there is a tradition that far back in eternity, there was attempted the eventuation of the 28,012th master architects. One more.